Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. In the news this week, all eyes are on South Carolina as the Democratic presidential nomination contest races forward. And then it's Super Tuesday, where millions of voters will have their say next week. So how will all of that have an impact on the next Democratic presidential debate, which is tomorrow night? Meanwhile, off the campaign trail, President Trump is in India on an official visit. The coronavirus is spreading, and jurors in the Harvey Weinstein case deliberate for a fifth day. So this hour on Point, the week ahead in the news. And let's start with a focused look on South Carolina. And to do that, we're joined now by Major Garrett. He's CBS News' chief Washington correspondent, and he will be one of the moderators for tomorrow night's debate in South Carolina. He joins us now from Charleston. Major, it's good to talk to you.
Great to be with you.
Okay, so first of all, for that last debate in Nevada, we had record numbers of people watching, almost 20 million people. So it seems like the pressure is on for the South Carolina debate. How significant do you think it might be, given that we'll have the South Carolina primary and then Super Tuesday just a few days later?
Well, because Super Tuesday is right after the South Carolina primary, we anticipate a very large audience because curiosity is running high. There was a curiosity factor for that Nevada debate because Mike Bloomberg qualified just the day before. A lot of people wanted to see, what does that look like? What does it sound like? They'd seen his ads, wanted to see what he looked on the debate stage. Most of the reviews were charitable, bad, if non-charitable, a disaster. So there's going to be a second Bloomberg effect for this debate. There's going to be a tremendous focus on Senator Bernie Sanders. He comes into South Carolina with undisputed, widespread momentum, not only in fundraising and organization, but the big win in Nevada now has let his campaign say, let's not just compete in South Carolina, let's win in South Carolina, bury Vice President Joe Biden and all the rest, and maybe Bloomberg hangs around, but let's use that as a springboard towards Super Tuesday. And with look-in audiences from California, Texas, North Carolina, Virginia, Minnesota, Massachusetts, all voting on Super Tuesday, it's going to be a big event.
So given that millions of voters will be casting their primary ballots a week and a day from today, this will be the candidate's major chance to actually speak to all of them outside of South Carolina. So what are you hoping as moderator to draw from the candidates to hear from them?
So we have a couple of priorities. One of our partners here in South Carolina is the Congressional Black Caucus Institute. And in lots of conversations with them, they do believe, and I think they believe with some legitimacy, that issues related to people of color in our country, Hispanic, Latino, African-American, and the like, have, if not been glossed over, not been given the kind of specific, detailed questions and answer segments. We're really going to try to accomplish that here in South Carolina, not just because it's of interest to South Carolinians, as it is, but these issues are interesting to Californians and Texas. We're going to talk about housing in South Carolina, which we will. We have a whole eviction rate crisis, which is big in South Carolina, very big in Virginia, as well as it is in California. Education issues are going to get a considerable focus. We are going to at least attempt that. One thing we know as moderators is when candidates start running and going at each other and taking their own initiative, even though you have a stack of impressive questions, you may not get to them all. But we're really going to try to focus on some of those issues that go deeper and speak to either economic disparities that have existed in this country for a long time or issues that people of color simply don't think have been asked and answered. We're really going to try to accomplish that.
Housing, healthcare, the economy, jobs, immigration,
education, criminal justice, all of those things, as well as national security. So it's a lot. It's a 2-hour debate. As I said, we're going to make every effort we can. I've been in debate prep in South Carolina since Friday. I can tell you it's an exhausting process. It's a detailed, meticulous process. And we're going to do our level best to get those issues out and at least give candidates a chance to not only speak for themselves, but if they see important points of contrast with one another, let people hear what those are as well.
I've always been curious about this, Major, and especially after what happened in the Nevada debate. Some of the perhaps the most revealing moments come when the candidates are engaging or with each other or going after themselves. So going after each other. As a moderator, how are you going to try to balance what can be revealed in those moments versus, you know, things getting out of hand?
It's a very fine line, and I've done two presidential debates before. This will be my third. I've never been the lead anchor, but I've been a participant, a moderator, and there's a difference when you're the lead anchor or when you're someone who's just asking questions. So I won't be the lead anchor. I won't be the principal lion tamer on stage. I never have been. It's a delicate art because, to your point, when candidates really start engaging and creating those sparks and points of difference, you don't want to be the referee that pulls them apart and slows down that momentum. But you also don't want a scenario in which people actually can't hear because there's too much clamor. There's too much friction. There's sort of too much energy in the room. And all you hear are voices clashing with one another, piling on top of one another, and no one actually distills any particular insight or fact or policy point. So it's a very delicate art. We're going to do our best. But Gayle King and Norah O'Donnell, that will be probably their principal obligation in addition to asking the lion's share of the question.
So, Major, last question for you. Given that you you have moderated several of these debates, give our listeners some advice here. What do you think they ought to be looking for or listening for that would be helpful to them tomorrow night?
So have an extra large bowl of popcorn. And what I mean by that is don't find yourself saying, well, the first segment is over. All the best stuff has happened. That's not what happens in debates, even though usually that first segment has the most firepower. Because why? The candidates come out. They come out on the balls of their feet. They come out really aggressive. If they have lines that they really want to land, they want to land them early. And then there's a sense, oh, we go to a commercial break. All the best stuff is over. That's not going to be the case in this debate. It isn't in most debates, but we really are trying to stack as many substantive, issue-driven, and these underlying questions about what to do about education, what to do about housing, what to do about economic disparities. And we believe those questions, both substantively and from a political contrast point of view, will make this a lively debate throughout. So be ready.
Well, Major Garrett is Chief Washington Correspondent for CBS News. He's speaking to us today from Charleston, South Carolina, where he will be one of the moderators for tomorrow night's Democratic presidential debate. Major, thanks so much, and we'll look forward to watching you tomorrow night.
Thank you so very much.
All right, let's take a moment to listen to what one of the Democratic presidential hopefuls had to say following the Nevada debate last week, and of course the Nevada caucuses that came soon thereafter. Here's Elizabeth Warren saying that her disappointing results in Nevada don't reflect the energy around her campaign, according to her, because her debate performance actually gave her quite a lift.
Since Wednesday night, our support has been growing everywhere. Since I stepped on that stage, a quarter of a million people have gone to ElizabethWarren.com and pitched in their $25. In 3 days, people have contributed $9 million to this campaign.
And Senator Warren told reporters on Sunday that because of those donations, she says her campaign does have the resources to compete in South Carolina and then on to Super Tuesday. Well, joining us now is Robert Costa. He's national political reporter for The Washington Post and moderator for PBS Washington Week with us from the nation's capital. Robert Costa, it's good to have you.
Good to be with you.
Okay, so we can talk about the debate more, but I really want to just focus on the importance of the South Carolina primary itself. For people like Senator Elizabeth Warren and particularly Vice President Joe Biden, is South Carolina going to be a make or break moment for Biden, for example?
especially for former Vice President Joe Biden, it is a make-or-break moment. For months, we've been hearing about his strength with African-American voters who were a majority of the Democratic electorate in South Carolina. And following some tough results in the initial contest in this presidential race, Vice President Biden needs a strong showing, based on conversations with his own allies, to go into Super Tuesday just a few days later with political strength and momentum to try to assert himself as the alternative to Senator Sanders. And it's not just about coalescing support in South Carolina. It's about sending a signal to other moderates in the race and voters that he, not former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, is best positioned to take on Sanders.
So would that signal come with a clear win in South Carolina? Or does Biden have to simply have come in, you know, a close second or even a close first, for example?
A commanding victory of more than 5 percentage points would be very helpful to Biden, based on my conversations with Democratic officials. At the same time, Biden has vulnerability because, as we all know in presidential politics, momentum and results, they matter to voters who factor those things into their own decisions when they go into that ballot box. And you see Senator Sanders in recent polls making gains among African-American voters. He lost South Carolina in a near disastrous way in 2016 to Secretary Clinton. Ever since then, he's built up relationships in the African-American community. And you've seen him in recent polls narrow the gap with Biden. And most importantly for Sanders, the Nevada caucuses showed that he does have an ability to expand his own electorate. He's been challenged for months about whether he's just appealing to hardcore liberal voters, self-declared democratic socialists. But he showed in Nevada that he can win older voters, African-American voters, Latino voters. The question now for Sanders is, can he carry that into South Carolina?
And thereafter, I think the thing that one of the reasons why South Carolina becomes of even more importance is that Super Tuesday is only 3 days later. So if momentum has ever mattered, it's at this moment right now, isn't it?
Super Tuesday is usually not this close to the South Carolina primary. So for Vice President Biden and other moderates in the race who are lagging behind Sanders, they need this bounce into Super Tuesday.
Well, Robert Costa is national political reporter for The Washington Post. Hang in there, Bob, for just a moment. We are taking a look at the news in the week ahead. Lots of politics. We'll also talk about coronavirus later this hour as well. We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are taking a look at what to expect in the week ahead in the news. It's going to be another big week. I know we say that every single week, but it is true. I'm joined today by Robert Costa. He's national political reporter for The Washington Post. Let's listen to a little bit of what Senator Bernie Sanders said in the wake of his victory in the Nevada caucuses. He announced the victory to a crowd in Houston, Texas, that he had won Nevada, and he called Nevada just yet another step in the beginning of his campaign.
We are going to win here in Texas. We are going to win across the country because the American people are sick and tired of a president who lies all of the time. They are sick and tired of a corrupt administration. They are sick and tired of a president who is undermining American democracy.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders following his win in the Nevada caucuses. But of course, the question now is what will happen next in South Carolina? Joining me now from Washington is Kimberly Atkins. She's WBUR's senior news correspondent. Kimberly, it's good to talk to you.
Hi, Magna.
And also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst. Jack, it's welcome to Monday once again. It's a busy Monday already.
Hello, Magna.
Okay, so Kimberly, let me ask you, we already heard some of Bob's original or preliminary thoughts about the importance of South Carolina. What do you think? How vital is it for the candidates who are not Bernie Sanders to do well in South Carolina?
Well, it's vital for all of the candidates, including Bernie Sanders, moving forward with his momentum from the previous wins. This is the first time that we will have a primary in a state where the majority of voters are minority, where the 60% roughly of Democratic primary voters are Black. And it's really the first time that there has been a critical mass of Black people weighing in on this election. And for all of the reasons Major pointed out earlier, that there are so many issues that these voters have been listening very closely at these candidates about and will listen to at the debate. But it really will measure that. That was supposed to be Joe Biden's firewall, his support among minority members. But what we saw in Nevada with Latino voters was that Bernie Sanders was able to capture nearly half of that vote there. So what that can do is signal voters in South Carolina, in places like Texas and California, hey, this is a candidate that voters of color are listening to. Maybe I shouldn't rule them out as somebody who doesn't appreciate what the interests are or who other voters can get behind. So Bernie Sanders can pick up. He probably won't get a majority, but if he picks up a sizable amount, that'll be big, big trouble for Joe Biden and other folks in that non-Bernie Sanders lane.
Right. So, Jack, reflect on what Kimberly just said, especially in terms of what Sanders' victory in Nevada reveals about how his campaign is expanding and possibly attracting voters that previously weren't thought to be potential Bernie Sanders supporters.
Well, I think it goes to the essence of his appeal, and this is lit up extraordinarily by a piece of reporting in BuzzFeed by Ruby Cram. And she quotes it. She goes to a town hall where Bernie town hall, and a woman stood up and said she said people are ashamed if they don't earn enough money. And Bernie waved that away. He said that attitude is instilled by the system. He says the system wants you to be ashamed. And Bernie, he says, my campaign makes people feel less alone, makes people in paycheck to paycheck America feel less alone because they're not alone in their struggle. That struggle is the American struggle. And he's saying to people who are held down by the myths of American individualism, it is not your fault. It is the fault of this, as he said in his speech at the victory speech in Nevada, it's the fault of this unjust system. I want to wreck the system. That's the danger. But that is an immensely powerful appeal to free people from that sense of isolation and from that shame. And it's parallel, really, to the remarkable pitch, the similar persuasion of Donald Trump. What does he say to his core supporters? I free you from your resentment. I free you from political correctness. Yes, I free you even from your racism. Say whatever you want. You can go ahead and do it. That's a very powerful appeal to them, too. Basically, he's saying, demobilize your conscience. That's rigged up by liberal elites, and just speak out your heart. Bernie says, on the economic side, stop the guilt. Don't blame yourself. It's the system.
Well, so, Jack, but exactly on that point, when Sanders says, it's not your fault, it is the fault of the system, or sometimes he'll point directly to quote unquote billionaires. it's not your fault, it's the fault of X. I mean, the president, President Donald Trump, he pointed to actually other individuals, like immigrants, as the people who bore the blame. Now, that to me, that seems quite different. Even if the core message is I'm freeing you of shame and guilt, it's like who are they blaming it on? Is the question.
Oh, whoa, yeah. Indeed, right. Indeed. And, you know, Bernie blames it on the 1%. Trump blames it on all seemingly non-white Americans and immigrants. The one is a economic populism. The other is a right-wing cultural populism. My point is that it therapeutically, it's the same effect, freeing people from their inhibitions, from their guilt, from their shame at their condition, at their heart. Mm-hmm.
Let's go to Chris, who's calling from Columbia, South Carolina. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. As a longtime resident of South Carolina, I am predicting that Bernie Sanders will win the South Carolina primary because of his momentum coming into the state. He is polling ahead. My concern is, thus far, combined with the other candidates, they are far outpacing Bernie with the support, with the numbers. And as long as they stay in, I do think that Bernie will become the nominee. However, if he is the nominee, I don't think he has a snowball's chance in a fiery furnace of beating Donald Trump because America will never elect a socialist president.
Mm. Well, Chris, thank you for your call. Bob Costa, do you want to respond to Chris?
We live in a global populist age. So as a reporter, I'm always hesitant to say this can happen or this won't happen. And based on my reporting over the weekend for today's front page in the Washington Post, it's evident that the Democratic Party is now having a reckoning. They're grappling with the rise of the new left. And the new left has echoes of the old left coming out of the 1960s, the push for civil rights, more federal involvement in different issues. But now you see in Senator Sanders, a longtime traveler in that political space, who was an outlier for years, if not decades, in the Democratic ranks. Now he finds himself atop a movement that is competing with President Trump to define populism as this country moves forward. And that has resonance with a lot of people who feel like the global economy has left them behind. And so though he's an unorthodox candidate, he's older. He's not exactly what you would think is a natural presidential candidate in terms of being polished or being centrist. He has appeal to many Democratic voters in this specific time and place.
Mm. So, Kimberly, then where does that leave candidates like Pete Buttigieg or Amy Klobuchar, for example? I mean, Joe Biden has a long-term political history and deep relationships with sort of the historical African-American power base in South Carolina. So we know about that. But Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, where does that leave them?
This is going to be one of their toughest races yet in South Carolina. They have not really resonated. As you said, they don't have that long history in South Carolina. Their campaigns have not really resonated at all with voters of color. That's a 1-2 punch in South Carolina. But even moving beyond South Carolina into Super Tuesday, where all that leaves all of the candidates who are not Bernie Sanders. We've seen this split. First, it was between the, you know, more liberal progressives and the more moderates. Now it's become a clear two-lane race, one with Bernie Sanders and one with everybody else. And each of those people are trying to say, hey, I'm the unity candidate that can bring together a majority of voters who are the folks in this lane against Bernie, who is at the lead, but with a plurality. And no one has broken out to claim that title yet, as much as all of them are trying. The thought a couple months ago is that that would be Joe Biden, but he hasn't been able to make that clear case to knock the other folks out yet.
Mm. Well, to your point, Kimberly, in Pete Buttigieg's speech following Nevada, he named Senator Sanders and calling him a candidate that wouldn't unify America. But looking forward to South Carolina, Buttigieg was at a church in Charleston, South Carolina, recently, and here's what he had to say.
It is especially humbling in the middle of Black History Month to think about what it means to stand before African American voters and ask them for their vote. Because I know that that vote is not just an expression of a political preference. It is something that was hard won. That vote is something that was kept, often through violence, out of black hands for generations.
Pete Buttigieg in Charleston, South Carolina. Kimberly, Buttigieg has had a very, 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 very large mountain to climb with African-American voters here. Do you see him making any headway?
Not so far. It's been very difficult. And it's in part because there have been other candidates in the race who came in with far more support, like Joe Biden. But I think it goes beyond the issues that he's had in South Bend involving the police and fire department. Black voters are pragmatic. They want someone who can beat Donald Trump, but they also want someone who has a clear understanding of the issues that they face. That's a subset of this desire to beat Donald Trump. A president who they see as really an existential threat to a lot of black communities in the policies that he's been carrying out. So they've been listening very carefully to what candidates have been saying about things like health care, about things like housing and economics. And they've been looking for specific things that not only that these candidates can do, but a sign that they really understand and have a feel for what is going on in their households, in their communities. And Pete Buttigieg just has not been able to make that case to them yet. What could likely happen in South Carolina and onward is, while together, if the black voters really unite as a bloc against a candidate, that can be a powerful, powerful thing. The vote might be split. You might see Bernie Sanders getting double digits of black voters and Joe Biden and others. And that really splits that vote a lot and sort of makes it even more muddled, this other non-Bernie Sanders lane for those candidates, where none of them may really emerge from South Carolina with any more momentum than they had going in.
Jack, before we move into talking about the other news coming up this week, I did want to sort of get your read on tomorrow night's debate, especially given what happened in the Nevada debate. What kind of things are you going to be looking for?
Well, the thing I'm looking for is the animus that Amy Klobuchar bears toward Mayor Pete. It was well described by Monica Hess in the Washington Post. She said, Klobuchar was the unleashed id of frustrated women everywhere. She was there on the stage, incandescently angry over Pete's express elevator ascent and everything it negated about her own hardworking, box-checking, uphill trudge. Here's a woman who's been in public life, high public office, for 20 years, who's, you know, won in, as she says, in red districts and so on, victory after victory. And here is essentially the mayor of the fourth largest city in Indiana, who has no place to go in Indiana politics. So he decides, well, I'm a Rhodes Scholar, I'm a Harvard graduate, I'm real smart, I'm 38, I'm going to run for president. And suddenly he's beating her. He's the white male. He's got the privilege, and it's there in his self-confidence. It's there in his urbanity, his self-assurance. And she is just furious to see this really social dynamic, something that happens in workplaces every day, every moment of every day, playing out right in front of her, and she can't stop it. Meanwhile, of course, the World Economic Forum recently came up with this statistic that at current rates, it would take 257 years for women to achieve economic parity with men in, quote, economic participation. So 257 years, that shouldn't take that's bagatelle.
Right. Well, Bob Costa, I haven't forgotten that you're there, but I got to go back to Kimberly on this one, because Kimberly, I have to say, when I was watching their interactions in Las Vegas, Buttigieg and Klobuchar, I do think, I mean, Jack's right. Like, every time Pete Buttigieg just sort of stepped in the middle of Klobuchar's answer, you could almost feel like sort of a collective grinding of teeth of many hundreds of millions of women across the country, don't you think?
Yes, I think that has been one of the biggest things that Pete Buttigieg has faced, particularly in the debates, when he's standing side by side with Amy Klobuchar and some of the other candidates. He's been a mayor of a very small city. He's, you know, got fewer votes to get his position, his former position, than a lot of, you know, city councilors in major cities get to get theirs. And there is this feeling, this idea that that is representative of the patriarchy, of the inherent advantages that men, particularly white men, have in politics and in just about every industry. So that's something that he really has had to fight against. And at the end of the day, you know, Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg are sort of occupying sort of that same Midwestern moderate lane, and they're elbowing it out. And this is one of the ways that that's really apparent during the debates.
And to be clear, this does not take away from his strong showings in the primary and caucuses that we have had so far. But as Jack was saying earlier, if a lot of what ultimately helps drive voter decision is how they feel about the candidates, maybe that was one of the other reasons why tomorrow night's debate in South Carolina will be so important. So Jack Beatty, Kimberly Atkins, and Robert Costa, hang in there for just a second. We will talk a lot about coronavirus and about a major ongoing shakeup in U.S. intelligence agencies when we come back. This is On Point.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking about what to expect in the week ahead in the news. I'm joined today by Robert Costa. He's national political reporter for The Washington Post. Kimberly Atkins is also with us. She's WBUR senior news correspondent in Washington. And Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst in Hanover, New Hampshire, is also with us. So let's talk about a lot of news that's still percolating in U.S. intelligence agencies. First of all, just to remind folks, that last week and actually even prior to that, there were reports of Russia's interference in the U.S. election, this 2020 election, including reports that Russia's desire to help both Senator Bernie Sanders and President Donald Trump. So here's how Senator Sanders responded to those reports. He said this on Friday in Bakersfield, California.
Let me tell Mr. Putin, the American people, whether you're Republicans, Democrats, independents, are sick and tired of seeing Russia and other countries interfering in our elections. The intelligence community has been very clear about it. Whether Trump recognizes it or not, or acknowledges it or not, they did interfere in 2016. The intelligence community is telling us they are interfering in this campaign right now, in 2020. And what I say to Mr. Putin, if elected president, trust me, you are not going to be interfering in American elections.
Senator Sanders on Friday in California. Now, White House National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien was on ABC's This Week on Sunday. He said this about those intelligence reports about Russia and interfering in the U.S. election.
Well, there are these reports that they want Bernie Sanders to get elected president. That's no surprise. He honeymooned in Moscow. The President Trump has rebuilt the American military to an extent we haven't seen since Ronald Reagan. So I don't think it's any surprise that Russia or China or Iran would want somebody other than President Trump.
That's White House National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien. And you just heard him say that he thinks it's not a surprise that Russia might be wanting to help Senator Sanders. But O'Brien also denied reports about an intelligence briefing to Congress that Russia is trying to help President Trump as well. So, Robert Costa, there's been a lot going on here. What's the latest on all the tumult in the intelligence agencies that we should be looking for in the week ahead?
The president is purging his ranks of people he perceives as disloyal. And this is being led not only by Robert O'Brien, the current national security advisor, but the president has enlisted longtime confidants like Johnny McEntee, a name most people don't know, but he's now running personnel at the White House along with Hope Hicks and others to come in. And this is a president post-acquittal who's acting with newfound confidence when it comes to his exertion of executive power. Already someone who tested the bounds of executive power, now post-acquittal, he feels like the guardrails, if they were ever there, are down and collapsed even further.
So Jack Beatty, have we seen this before? I mean, Nixon is the initial analogy people might turn to, but the idea that a U.S. president has tasked someone specifically with rooting out anyone who's believed to not be loyal to the president above all, is this a new chapter in American politics?
I'm sure it happens without being heralded in every administration. Here, it's part of the Trump way of governing, instill fear to exact conformity. And of course, conformity to what? To the daily line, which of course can change on a dime. So it's a difficult position for people working for the in the White House, and a difficult position indeed for the senators who may find their heads on pikes. Wasn't that the line attributed to someone at the White House? Head, you'll have your head on your pike if you dare defend defy the president in the impeachment trial, or indeed anywhere on any other front. So yeah, he rules by fear and by asking for loyalty above all. And this is just not how he governs. It's a threat to our system, because if people simply are going to not be loyal to the country, first of all, but to the president, we've got a cult of personality, not a responsible, answerable democratic system.
So Jack, let me explore that with you a little bit more, because, yes, I suppose one could say that presidents of the past have replaced folks in the executive if they weren't really aligned with that president's preferred policies, perhaps. But in this case, is that what is actually happening? Or is President Trump looking for people who are aligned with him as an individual, loyalty to him, not to his policy goals? To me, that's what I'm trying to understand. And I feel it is distinctly different.
Yes, that's the cult of personality part of it.
Yeah.
I am the state. Isn't that the what the monarch says? He is the state. You're loyal to me. Everything depends on that. And of course, each time, right, the sum of competence just dwindles in the White House. I mean, let's be this young man who's 29 years old, the new head of personnel. I mean, he used to hold Trump's suit coats at rallies, and now he's he's enforcing loyalty. Competence is at a premium, because these people, that's not why they're selected. Loyalty to Trump. That's all that counts.
Mm. Kimberly Atkins, your thoughts on this?
Yes. And when it comes specifically to the intelligence agency, this loyalty test is particularly concerned. I mean, it's folks that I know in the intelligence community who were expressing dire concern about purges happening there with the ouster of Joseph McGuire as acting director of national intelligence. in the intelligence agency, this isn't the first time that President Trump has disparaged it or tried to attack it in some way, specifically in response to their determination that Russia is meddling in an effort to try to help him. But folks I talked to say, look, it's undermining reforms that took place within the intelligence agencies over the past couple of decades that were made to instill greater confidence in it that came after the invasion of Iraq, which, as you recall, was based, according to the Bush administration, on Iraq's possession of weapons of mass destruction, which turned out not to be true. That dealt a severe blow to the intelligence agencies and the reforms that were put in place to really remove political considerations from intelligence assessments were seen as so important. This is absolutely undermining that.
So Bob Costa, then add to that here, because really the question for all of us as Americans is what impact would this have on the United States' ability to gather the most trustworthy evidence to present it to the president, even if it's bad news? I mean, what impact do you think this might have?
It could have a very sweeping effect on the way intelligence is understood. There's concern on Capitol Hill, mostly among Democrats, that the president is not preparing enough for election interference in 2020. You have pieces of legislation that sit idle in terms of preparing the government for not only Russian interference, but interference from other foreign actors. But the president is so committed to the idea that the Russia investigation was a hoax, his words, that he is resistant to doing anything that could question his political legitimacy. So you have throughout this administration many officials, based on my reporting, who walk on eggshells when they're around President Trump discussing election interference, knowing it has such political sensitivity in his mind.
Well, let's stay focused on the president here, but some great news for him, because he is in India, and India being one of the nations, by the way, that actually has a very positive view of President Trump and his leadership of the United States. The president addressed a massive crowd of more than 100,000 people this morning in India. His two-day visit is meant to help settle a trade dispute between the two nations and strengthen relationships, again, between the United States and India. So here's what the president had to say.
In America, we have come to know the splendor of Indian culture personally through the 4 million Indian Americans living in the United States as our wonderful friends, colleagues, and neighbors. They are truly spectacular people. Indian Americans enrich every aspect of our national life. They are titans of business, the biggest, the best, pioneers of science, masters of the art, and innovation of technology like few people have been able to see, no matter where you go, anywhere in this universe.
President Donald Trump speaking before 100,000 Indians today. Bob Costa, let me turn back to you on this. That clip there, obviously the president talking about Indian Americans, but I want to actually just focus on the relationship between the United States and India here, because actually under President Trump, that relationship has actually grown stronger, hasn't it?
It has. And when we think about President Trump as part of this rise of nationalism around the world, we often speak of the Brexit movement in the United Kingdom. But part of that broader conversation is the rise of Modi in India. He himself is a strident nationalist, someone who speaks about India in the same way President Trump uses the phrase "Make America Great Again." He's also highly controversial in the way he has treated Muslims in India. His critics say he is effectively excluding them from society as much as possible, creating tensions that have long been simmering between the Hindu and Muslim communities in India. He's exacerbated it, those tensions, in the eyes of his critics. And President Trump is embracing not only an ally in terms of trade, but an ally in terms of how these men, these leaders, approach the idea of nationalism versus being part of a global project.
Jack Beatty, these state visits are really moments for presidents to showcase their leadership of the United States to global audiences. I mean, do you think the president has done thus far in India, and what's the significance of that?
Well, he seems to be being received with great glee. A writer in the New York Times finds a similarity between Modi's India and Trump's America. He writes, this is Pankaj Mishra, an Indian writer, "A democracy once identified with great names such as Mohandas Gandhi has degenerated into Trump land, an inferno of systemic brutishness, imbecility, and mendacity." Well, that's a view, you know, but it is, it's a different president took a trip there, Jimmy Carter in 1978. And I have a quick anecdote about that. He went to a village, tiny village. He was on a stage and the hetman of the village came up and Carter was going to present him with a gift. Thousands of people in the audience. The gift was a mahogany viewfinder that someone had given the State Department in the 19th century. And President Carter handed it to the leader. The man held it up to the sun to look at it. The president showed him how to press the lever. He pressed it, and he screamed. He threw it down. He ran off the stage. People, pandemonium, panic. What happened? Carter picked up the viewfinder, looked in it, and there's a slide from Jaws with the shark just leaping out. Such are the vicissitudes of diplomacy.
Okay, so let's stick with the world news here for just a couple of minutes to wrap up today's program. Kimberly Atkins, there has been ongoing and growing concerns over coronavirus with, for example, in Italy, some towns there under lockdown now as the virus spreads. What are your thoughts about sort of the political and public health infrastructure on preparedness here in the United States? What should we be thinking about regarding coronavirus this week?
Well, certainly we should be watching as the CDC and other U.S. agencies talk about preparedness. There still has only been a handful of cases here in the United States, but we're seeing in places like Italy how it can explode so quickly. And it's still unclear what the infrastructure is here, how you test for it, how you protect against it. Still a lot of unanswered questions. But a big thing that we're seeing already is the economic impact. It's really affecting markets. Now, recall, this is an election year, and the economy is something that Donald Trump is banking on remaining strong for his chances of reelection. Already, we are seeing that it hit, you know, this is undermining that new China trade deal because it's hitting manufacturing. It's hitting travel. Airlines are reporting losses already. It's hitting the stock market as fears about coronavirus and how it's being addressed both here and internationally continue to grow. So that's what I'm looking for.
Right. Excellent point. Bob Costa, your thoughts on the potential political and economic implications of coronavirus?
Well, the markets already are floating around a drop of 800 to 900 points as we approach midday here on Monday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average could face a 3% drop by the end of the day, if not more. We'll see how that all develops by the end. You see, politically, President Trump turning to Secretary Azar and the CDC to handle this. But the question now facing this Trump administration is, what will they do on the national security front to prepare the U.S. to take a step forward internationally? Will they call a Security Council meeting at the United Nations? Will there be quarantines ever set up at U.S. military bases? And the president has tried to assure people that this will eventually die down as an issue. But if it becomes a global pandemic, his accountability will be front and center here in the United States.
Well, Jack Beattie, you've got about 30 seconds left here. Just wanted to hear your thoughts on the growing concerns around coronavirus.
Well, I share them. Everyone does. But, you know, we have normalized the other virus, the flu. Mm-hmm. And every year it kills, what, 10, 15, 20,000 Americans. Surely we can, you know, this potential pandemic is worrying, but the epidemic every year of influenza and its toll on infants, elderly, we've got to do better in public health. We simply have to. That's intolerable that every year so many people should die from this preventable infection.
Right. Well, Jack Beattie, On Point News Analyst, it's always great to talk with you, Jack. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And Kimberly Atkins, WBUR senior news correspondent in Washington. Kimberly, thank you.
Thank you, Magna.
And Robert Costa, national political reporter for The Washington Post and moderator of PBS Washington Week. Bob, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.